For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.
All right, let's get back into this. It's been a long break. Welcome back. Okay, so let's do a quick review to get back where we are up to. We'll review the story. We're not going to review all the Rashis and the Rambans that we've done, because that will take another 3 months, the same three months that we took to learn it. So we are holding in our story of Yaakov, and it's like been forever. So we're in the final episode, the final confrontation between Yaakov and Esav, a story which began with Yaakov returning from over 20-plus years with his uncle Laban. Now he's returning with 4 wives and 11 children and great flock, great wealth. He sends messengers to Esav, his brother, telling him that he's coming to find favor in his eyes, and Esav responds basically by going out with his 400 men to greet him. Yaakov prepares for war. He does his 3 things. He divides up his camp. He davens, and then he sends this great tribute to his brother Esav. We've been through all of that, and then what we're up to right now within this final episode is what happens after the tribute has been sent. Yaakov spends the night across the river, wakes up in the middle of the night and says, I have to cross my family over this little river, which he does. And the Torah describes that Yaakov remained alone back on that original side, and a man came to wrestle with him, and a man was unable to defeat him, but at daybreak said to Yaakov, I need to leave. Let's read this part inside, because that's what we're going to be focused on. That's where we're up to. As we get ready for this final episode, let's read from verses 25. It's on page 503. Everybody got me? Page 503, verse 25. I'm just going to read the English just to get us back into the story. Yaakov was left alone, and someone wrestled with him until the break of day. So this person, the Torah describes it as an Ish. Yaakov, the sages, as Rashi has quoted, describes it as the angel of Esav, comes to fight with him until daybreak. That's, of course, going to be a very significant point that Rav Hirsch is going to spend a great deal on, about the concept of the fight takes place at night when it's dark and you can't see, and then as soon as the rays of light are shown upon the earth, the fight is going to end. 26. When this man saw that he could not prevail against him, he gripped the joint of his thigh, and the joint of Yaakov's thigh was dislocated as he wrestled against him. So we have this idea that even though the man picked the fight, so that we had assumed the man thinks he could win and would be victorious, but at daybreak he sees that he could not. But then what he can do is hurt Yaakov. He can dislocate this joint by the thigh. And then he says, let me go, for the day breaks and I have to get out of here. And then Yaakov, who was on the short end of the one being hurt, now is in control and says, I will only let you go if you bless me. Verse 28, flipping over to page 506. The angel then says, okay, what is your name? Yaakov responds by sharing his name. His name is Yaakov. And the angel says, your name will no longer be called as Yaakov, but Yisrael, for you has power with God and with men, and you have been able to do that which you desired, meaning you were able to fight me and withhold your ground. So your name will no longer be called Yaakov, it'll be called Yisrael. Yaakov then asks him his name, tell me your name. And he says, why do you bother asking my name? And he blessed him there. That was our story. We've been through this a number of times, I'm sure you recall, but this is just good review to get us back into the flow of things, as we're going to now see the comments from Rav Hirsch. So we have this wrestling match. The last piece that we had learned actually in Rav Hirsch was about the wrestling match, which is on page 504. We had read through verse 25, and let's quickly do that again just to get back into things. Hello, come on in.
Thank you.
If you see on page 504, the second to last paragraph, or let me just quote one line actually from the paragraph, it's the third paragraph in. The dust that floated about from these two wrestlers, so runs the saying of our sages, was the dust that rose to the throne of God. For this fight is a prototype of the fight which lasts through the whole of history. It is the meaning of which the whole of history really is. So our first point out that what we're going to be studying in this battle between Yaakov and Esav in this wrestling match really is a paradigm of the world history battle that's taking place between the descendants of Yaakov and the descendants of Esav. And so as we're going to go through now, Rav Hirsch is going to point it out, but he sets us up by saying that this is going to be a world-class perpetual battle between Yaakov and Esav. And then just one other line, and as long as night reigns on earth, the beginning of the fourth paragraph, as long as the consciousness and the minds of men are confused and things are not recognized clearly and distinctly for what they really are, then during that time, then he will have to reckon on struggle and opposition. And we will constantly struggle with Esav and what Esav represents during the night. Nighttime representing Golos, exile, without the rays of sun to show us the way. It's during that time where things are not clear, not understood, ambiguous. That's where we will have the cry out of distress of Yaakov during his fight and the ability of Esav to really wrestle with him and hold him down because of that as far as night goes. But there will be a time when dawn will break. Dawn will break, the rays of sun will shine, and then the Tsar of Esav, the officer, the angel, so to speak, of Esav will be the one to say, "Let me go, I have to leave." Let's read. Let's pick up on the top of page 5. I think we might have covered this last time, but it's been so long, we'll just pick up from here as we continue on our story. Top of page 505. So what did the angel do to Yaakov? So again, he started the fight, so the angel thought he would be victorious, he would be able to win. Yaakov is able to withstand that attack. You cannot defeat me, but I can hurt you. Says Rav Hirsch, Vateka, how did he hurt him? He gripped the joint of his thigh, making it loose, making something hang. The yerech, the thigh, is the strong fleshy muscle which controls the hip bone on which the firm standing and walk on the ground is conditional. We pointed out, as we just read through the verses, why the hip bone? If the angel can maim Yaakov, why that joint? And again, as Rav Hirsch is going to point out, clearly it's significant because it's become eternal to the Jewish people that we don't eat the vein from that area, because we have to always recall this battle. So what's so special about that battle? Says Rav Hirsch, that fleshy muscle is that which controls firm standing and walking on this earth. His opponent wanted to lift Yaakov up off of the ground and throw him down completely. In this he saw he would not succeed. To be able to take Yaakov and completely remove him from this earth, completely remove his position, his standing, his ability to walk, have a role, couldn't do that. That's what he wanted to do. In other words, he wanted to win and he couldn't, so he hurt his hip socket. But what was he trying to do? So he was trying to pick him up. What are you doing in a wrestling match? Pick your opponent up and pin him down to the ground. Remove his standing, so to speak, literally. Figuratively and literally, you're standing on the ground to pick him up and throw him off of it. He could not succeed on that. So what he did, he gripped him from his hip joint, and as Yaakov resisted him, the muscle was torn from its ligaments so that he can no longer control the leg, so that Yaakov was rendered limping. So he couldn't pick him up and throw him down, but holding on to his hip joint socket somehow was able to dislocate that muscle. Says Rav Hirsch, significance. Accordingly, throughout the whole of the struggle at night, Yaakov's opponent tries to take the ground from under his feet, to give him no standing at all, to have no claim to exist at all on earth. Certainly sounds similar to those, you know, just coming out of the last calamity the Jewish people have had from the Holocaust. You have no ability to be here. No standing here. There's a claim that's gone on for thousands of years to completely take the ground out from under the Jews' feet. That he will not succeed in doing. We have a problem never. If you remember, just tying this into one of the blessings that Yaakov was given. Remember the different blessings, the stars of the heavens, the sand on the earth and the dust of the earth. What was the difference we said? If you remember, as we went through that, we said the stars in the heaven was that each Jew will be great, will be a world unto himself. The sand was a blessing in numbers and multitudes. But the dust was a blessing of?
Always come back,
right? Always be there. You can never get rid of it. So to completely pick up Yaakov and throw him down to the ground, showing you have no position here, you have no standing, that he can't succeed in. Never. But what he will be able to do will be to lame him, to weaken his material means, and to hinder him in using his natural abilities and strength for making steady progress on earth. Now, our person is going to talk about this more, but here he's already giving us a beautiful insight. The ability to walk is the ability to move, to progress. When you render that limp, when you maim that muscle that gives me the ability to run, to walk, to be strong and firm, what you've maimed is my ability to use, and then what's the significance of that, or the symbolism? The ability to take all of my resources and my strength that I have to make progress on earth. The Jews' goal on earth, this is a major part of Rav Hirsch's theology in terms of how he understands the whole scheme of things, is to be able to come to be this light unto the nations. That was a major part of his writing that the Jew was going to, and it's not just Rav Hirsch, that's well found that he just highlighted it very much. The Jew's ability to be in the world surrounded by the nations of the world in exile, and show, be that light unto the nations, and show what it means to be refined, educated, spiritual, moral, all of those things. But if I don't have the resources to do so, so then I'm hindered. It's as if I'm lame. I can't take all that I have and give it to the world because I'm weak. Says Rav Hirsch, this battle represents Esau will never be able to pick up Yaakov and throw him down and say, you have no standing here, but I will maim your hip joint, that fleshy muscle that allows me to have firm standing here to make progress, and will slow that progress because you will be damaged. You will be hurting financially, emotionally, physically throughout history by the hands of Esau, and therefore your ability to impact the world will be lessened or retarded because there's something holding you back. So you can't move forward in that same pace because of that. That says the first. He's going to talk more about the significance of this muscle, but that's what he's giving us right now as far as a little teaser. So far, so good?
Yeah.
Okay, verse 27. What happens in verse 27? Again, just reading the verse. So now Yaakov says, let me go. I'm sorry, the angel says, let me go for the day breaks. Even though the angel has been in control, the angel couldn't completely throw him down, but he heard him. Now he says, let me go. And Yaakov says, I'm in control now. Nothing doing until you bless me. What time does the angel say I need to go? It's daybreak. Says Rav Hirsch. Lo ashalech. Yaakov says, I will not. Literally, I shall not let you go, for only if you bless me. And he discusses the grammar of that phrase. Picking up the end of the third line. So Yaakov's opponent can only fight as long as it is night on earth. What we see from this verse is that this opponent that we're fighting, the opponent of Esav, only fights when it's dark, when it's night. And moreover, as long as it is night on earth, he seems to be, although indeed not the victor, still to be the stronger, to have the upper hand. When we are nighttime, where we are right now in exile, if you would say, who has the upper hand, the forces of Yaakov or the forces of Esav in the world? Says Rav Hirsch, it's Esav. There's no question about it. This is the world we live in. It's an Esav world or a Yaakov world? And it's an Esav world. There's no question about it. We are a presence, one that during many times in our history they would like to stamp out, but unsuccessfully. We are a presence in a world in which it's almost as if we don't belong. I say that almost very lightly, because it really is like we don't belong.
Especially today, it's getting worse.
That's just the reality. But that's as long as it's night, and that's symbolized by the fact that this force picked the fight with Yaakov and was clearly in control the entire time until daybreak.
Why does he lose his power at daybreak?
Oh, now you're asking the right questions. We're about to see.
Well, that's a question. I'm sorry.
I said, why won't the angel have his power at daybreak? Why does it stop at night?
That's exactly our next line. But as soon as the day begins to dawn, the reverse takes place. Something strange happens in our story, and it is Yaakov who imposes the conditions for the end of the fight. Now, this we pointed out just when we read the verses. This is it's a strange point in the story. If Yaakov's been barely holding his own, and he's the one who gets maimed, at daybreak, the one who's stronger should easily be able to push away the weaker one and go leave. It's a very odd story that Yaakov should be so damaged and yet be able to then control the terms of the end of the battle. The only thing that changes is
the light.
The light. That's the only thing that changes in the story, and yet in that, all of a sudden the power shifts. Says Rav Hirsch, that's not lost on me. That's a significant point, that with the breaking of day, there was a shift in power. Continues Rav Hirsch. And the condition which Yaakov sets for the fight to end, accordingly the whole purpose of the whole affair is the recognition that Yaakov deserves blessing and furthering instead of enmity and obstruction. What happens is, and we're not yet at what daybreak is. He hinted at a little bit we read about earlier. Daybreak refers to clarity of understanding that which is going on in the world. But what does Yaakov say when he says, bless me? So we discussed in Rashi and Ramban whether or not that means acknowledge that I have the right to the blessings. We're first just picking out, what does it mean when Yaakov says, what are the terms for me releasing you? Bless me. What does it mean? Let's read the phrase again. Recognition that Yaakov deserves blessing and furthering instead of enmity and obstruction. Until now, what's been the defining characteristic between the descendants of Esav to Yaakov? Enmity and obstruction. Enmity, hatefulness, and I obstruct everything you're trying to accomplish. I stop it. I don't want it. Says Yaakov, when you recognize that instead what I need is blessing and furthering, that I need all of your talents that the world has to offer, but to further what I stand for. I need all your technology and your smarts and your economy and all of your scientific, but not just for whatever purpose. For me, to further the purpose of what Yaakov brings to the world. That's the blessing. That's when I'll release you, when you recognize that. The recognition that in such blessing, the nations are only blessing themselves. And when you do so, you're the one who will benefit. When you, the nations of Esav, provide me with your blessings and furthering, that you yourselves will be blessed. So will the promise be fulfilled, v'nivruchu v'cho kol mishpachoso adamo v'zaracha, that through you, Yaakov, all the nations of the world will be blessed. The blessing that Yaakov will then bring to the world, the morality, the upstanding citizen, all that Yaakov and the Jewish people represent to the world, when you recognize that in furthering our cause, you too will be blessed. So Yaakov holds on to him and says, I'll let you go when you give me that blessing. When you say, for 2,000 years, I have only related to you with enmity and obstruction, and I realize now that I was slowing your progress, and that was actually slowing my own progress. That the world would have been a better place had I been furthering your message. Then, Yaakov says, when you say that, when I hear that, I'll let you go. You listen to these words. I'm just giving you my response. You listen to me like, I can't even imagine that. Can't even imagine that. Now, Rav Hirsch would say, of course you can't imagine that, because you're living in darkness. You're living in darkness. So we say, this is what, I'm reading into this. See, we read what he had to say. But in the same way as someone in darkness would say, I can't imagine what things will be like when it's light. We know that every day there's darkness. We know it. But imagine you were living in darkness and you never experienced sunlight before. You're living in a cave your whole life. And someone would try to explain to you your whole existence, Matt, just kind of what it's like living in darkness. You don't know that there's a table and a bookshelf. You have to feel your way around. You have no idea what your food looks like. You have no idea what the people around you, you just don't know. Someone says, one day we're going to remove that stone from the front of the cave and the cave will be filled with light. You'll be able to see everything in the cave at once. You say, it's impossible. I can see, like when I'm right in front of it, I can see a little bit with my eyes. But you're telling me I can stand here and see the whole cave at once? Impossible! So yeah, that when it's light, you can do that. If I've never, I don't, you could try to explain that to somebody who's never experienced light, that it's normal that I can see to the end of this room because it's light. I can't explain that. I can't explain what it's like to have the warmth of the clarity of the sunlight. Says the Hirsch, we are living in darkness. We're living in darkness. The presence of Hashem is not in the world. And there's this concept that day will break. And the dawn's light will shine. And we'll see the whole world's history. Say, really? At one time we'll understand it all? So yeah, it's impossible. How can you understand why everything happened? How can we understand why this and why that and how... I know you're so living in the dark, you can only see what's in front of your nose, and even then, barely. I'm telling you, when it's light, you can see a mile on a clear day. But you've never experienced that. So we read the words that the nations of the world are going to say, we made a mistake, we've been obstructing your progress, and we should have been furthering. I can't even imagine, that's ridiculous. That's like, I can't even say those words. So first, I know, because you're in the darkness saying words that will only be true when? When it's light. But you're living in darkness and you've never experienced light. So you don't know what that's like. But there's going to be a time when that rock at the front of the cave will be removed and the cave will become flooded with light. And all of a sudden Yaakov will say to Esav, when Esav says, I got to go. Yaakov says, you say that you've made a mistake for 2,000 years, that you've been obstructing my progress, and you're the ones who suffered because of that, even more than I have, and that we were the ones of the source of blessing. And it's impossible as it is to imagine, because it's dark. But there'll be a time when it'll be light. And in the same way, those living in the cave can't imagine how that will come about. So it's hard for us to imagine what's it going to be like when that happens. But there'll be a time where all of a sudden the world will just be flooded with light. And when that happens, says Rav Hirsch, Esav is going to flee. And we're going to hold them by the neck and say, bless us. It's pretty beautiful, isn't it? So Yaakov says, I'm going to read now in the words of Rav Hirsch. I'm halfway through this paragraph. So Yaakov says, throughout the whole long night, you have attacked me, have looked on me as an obstruction, the removal of which was to be striven for in endless, continuous attack. Your entire existence has been focused on getting rid of me. Now that daylight has come, you give up the fight. You say, whoops! But I will not do so. Now I'm the one in daylight who will say, not so fast. Not until you have paid me my due by acknowledging me, by blessing me. The purpose of history will not be accomplished by Yaakov being forced to be absorbed by the masses of the nations. It's not that the nations are going to be forced somehow to recognize and accept us, says Rav Hirsch. That's not going to be the purpose of history when they finally say, okay, instead of beating you up, we will accept you. Mm-mm. But by the reverse, that the nations will at last see, get the insight that it is just in the principles which had been represented and held aloft by Yaakov in the midst of his struggle for existence, that their happiness and security lies too. So it's not just that they accept us, in the words of our first, that we become absorbed into the nations of the world, but that they recognize that they need us for their happiness. If I could just one second. It would be the difference between saying, if only the UN would finally just say, okay, there'll be a regular nation like everyone else. That's not the purpose of history. Purpose of history is not for the UN to say, we hereby accept the nation of Israel like every other nation, and we will not censure them, 80% more than every other nation. We'll just treat them like everyone. That's not the purpose of history. Purpose is when the UN says, we need Israel for us. Imagine that? We need them for our well-being. That's when the purpose of history will be realized. And it's, and again, using that just as a model, it's as if when the light shines, the UN says, okay, we're not needed anymore. And the nation of Israel says, This union will not be disbanded until you make one final resolution. And that final resolution is that we've been wrong the whole time, that we actually need you for our well-being, our happiness, our security, for us to have moral behavior, for us to have countries that are safe places for everyone. We need you for that. Then the UN can say, our job here is done.
Alibi.
Yep, 100%. Yeah.
Rav Hirsch lived in a time similar to this.
Okay, I'm not sure what you mean by that. Maybe yes, maybe no. What do you mean?
The West.
Yeah, he lived in the Enlightenment.
The
yeah.
Place that the Jews lived in Germany when he was writing like this.
Mm-hmm.
So that it's understandable that he would see it that way, is what I'm really referring to.
Yeah, he lived, there was a... He lived during the time of the beginning of the Zionist movement. Zionism, as we know it, was born with Herzl in the late 1800s, early 1900s. But even Herzl himself was building on the shoulders of, in the 1850s, he already had the Chovev HaTzion, and movements already beginning. The world shifted in the 1800s, in the Enlightenment. And Rav Hirsch was against the move back to Eretz Yisrael, because what I was alluding to earlier, part of his worldview was the Jew will be successful and will bring the redemption by becoming that pillar amongst the nations, and that will herald the Messiah, not the idea of removing yourself from the nations and returning to the land of Israel before that light until the nations has happened.
Oh, so, the Reform movement was also coming.
Oh yeah, that was his battle. His battle was against the Reform movement.
Right.
So he had a very interesting stance in which the way the Jew would fulfill being the light unto the nations was amongst the nations of the world, and that would herald the final redemption, as opposed to saying we need to leave being amongst the nations of the world and set up our own society that would be a light unto the nations as a nation unto ourselves. So he felt he was against that. Right, it was the wrong way to do it.
But you don't know. How are you going to know
till this year? At the end of the day, someone came to him and said, Rabbi, should I move to Israel or should I stay here? He said, stay here, because we're going to bring the redemption through becoming a light to the nation here. In other words, if you lived in his community and you had the opportunity to move to Israel, you would ask him that question, what should I do? So he would say, stay here. If you asked me that question, you had the opportunity to go, I would say, go there.
Right, but you don't know who's right.
I'm just like, right. No, you're asking me a question, like, what should I do?
Right.
I don't know who's right. I'm saying,
right.
He saw the world in a way that would dictate him responding to a congregant of his saying, should I have an opportunity to move there? Should I or should I stay? He would say, stay. If a congregant came to me and said, I have equal opportunities there here, I would say, go. Just because I live 150 years about after him, and see the development differently, and I'm not saying he's right, he's wrong. I'm saying in 2014 that would be my response. I'm not saying I'm right or wrong either. I'm just saying if someone asked me, what should I do
here?
Right. All we could do is what we could do. We don't know if one way is right or wrong. You can go there, and who knows if it's right? Maybe it is. Maybe it's right for you, but
okay. Let us continue. But anyway, the beautiful, beautiful way of him understanding the concept of daybreak. So, what does the angel respond after Yaakov says, I'll only let you go after you bless me? He says, what's your name? Mm-hmm. And Yaakov says, Yaakov. He says, no longer Yaakov, but Yisrael. Says the first in 506, verse 29. Lo yoimar, they will no longer say or express your name as Yaakov. Not lo yikra. Lo yikra means we will not call your name. Lo yoimar means we won't express your name. Meaning, says the first, thy name shall no longer have the meaning or be explained as the one who is destined to hold on to the heel. Right now, that's what your name expresses. When we call you Yaakov, we're expressing you hold on to a heel. You're at the end. You're at the bottom. Not, it shall no longer be called, meaning we don't just say we won't be called it, but we won't express your name. But the name Yaakov itself shall be understood as now Yisrael, from the word Sarah, aspects of ruling, that of being superior or greater. Means literally, God is the all-conquering one. Meaning, who is superior to everything else in power and greatness. And here the angel declares that in truth is to be what the meaning of the condition which is expressed by Yaakov. Again, let's go over what we're saying over here. Meaning, let's read it. Let's keep reading it. Only when a Yaakov, one who to the outward appearances is under the heel of all others, obtains the victory over the most vicious attacks of enemies, fully equipped with all material means, does this victory show the existence of the spiritual power which outweighs all material might and power. Okay, let's take a break. We'll do that again in a second. What does Esav represent? So Esav represents coming with 400 men. He comes representing material power, great strength, physical resources, be it in money, be it in strength, power. What should happen to the weaker one when the overpowering one attacks him? Should lose. What's the only explanation when the smaller one, the weaker one, is victorious? So if Hirsch represents, it doesn't make sense. It doesn't make sense. The weaker one should win. You can't win. How could the weaker one defeat the stronger one?
God's with you.
So there must be a spiritual power here. Ken Spiro is a historian who works for Eshet Torah. He lectures. He comes here. He's been here a couple of times to Atlanta. So he wrote a book called World Perfect, in which he describes that seven, if I recall correctly, seven principles that the modern world holds to be either self-evident or true or moral pillars of the world, were really not always that way. And it was the Jews and their Torah that introduced those principles to the world, which now seem to be like, duh, of course, that's what a moral person would do. And he goes through, for example, infanticide. Infanticide, killing babies. So today we would say, that's horrific. And he goes through significant cultures who were considered modern, progressive, moral, like Rome and Greece, would regularly engage in killing babies that were either what we would call special needs, left-handed, too many girls. They would just leave them on hilltops to die. And it was standard Roman, Greek behavior. So he goes through seven examples of this in which we would look at something today and say, like, horrible, where society didn't think it was horrible. Who introduced to the world that that's horrible? It was the Jew and his Torah who introduced it to the world. One of the principles in his book is the concept of caring for the weak. Caring for he who can't care for himself. And that what we would call in modern day and age a Darwinian thought process of let the weak be killed for the betterment of society was the overriding principle. Might makes right, and might needs to survive, and killing of the weak is the betterment of society. That was standard thought process in many, many societies. And it was the Jew and his Torah came along and said, you care for the widow, you care for the orphan, you care for the poor, you care. Your responsibility as the strong is not to cut them out to make you stronger. is to care for them to make you stronger. When you care for the weak, it's a different type of strength. It's not a physical strength, it's a moral strength. The Jew introduces that. Because really what should happen is the stronger should always overpower the weaker. The weaker shouldn't have a standing in society. They should be overrun and left to the side. That Darwinian approach is what should be. How can it be that the weaker overruns the stronger? It just doesn't make sense. The strong should always win. Except if the weaker have something else in their corner. That would be the spiritual. There's something about the weaker being able to defeat the stronger. That's the Jewish God. I don't know how into sports you are, but there's something that grabs, I don't know if it's just me or if it's people, about the underdog winning. The big mighty team comes in, and they're heavily favored, and somehow the weaker team pulls it off. They're inspired. They do everything. They play their hearts out. There's something moving about that, because it goes against the grain. The stronger should win. The weaker needs something to be able to win. So in sports, you could say maybe it's inspiration from the coach. But in life, what allows the weaker to win? How could it be? The weaker society should always be stamped out. And if you look at world history, it's true probably 100% of the time.
Except
this one little nation called the Jewish people, who not only somehow managed to work through history without being stamped out, they then even at the end, when that light shines into the cave, are going to become the victor. How is that possible? Says the first, reading it again. I'm going to start from only when at Yaakov, in the middle of the paragraph, towards the end of a line. Only when a Yaakov, one who to all outward appearances is under the heel of others. Look at it outwardly. Are we the strongest nation? Are we the wealthiest nation? Are we the largest nation? On outward appearances, we're under the heel of others. But when that nation who's under the heel obtains the victory over the most vicious attacks of enemies, fully equipped with all material means, does this victory show the existence of a spiritual power which outweighs all material might and power? Does this remind you of a certain story of a yontif that we celebrate every year?
Hanukkah.
This is a Hanukkah story.
It reminds me of the Saturday night talk here also.
Right. This is exactly the Hanukkah story. This is a story of an overpowering, materially well-equipped, well-trained Greek army, most powerful in the world, being defeated by a bunch of nomads, a bunch of guerrilla soldiers who are farmers and scholars. And you say, how can that happen? Only if you say there's a spiritual power behind it. For those of you who are here on Saturday night, what Dina's referring to, the raid in 81 on the Iraqi nuclear reactor, the whole story is one incident after another of, that doesn't make sense, that can't be. The attack in 67, the beginning of the Six-Day War, they'll tell you the same thing. You want to hear about the 73 War? They'll tell you the same thing. You go through the stories of even modern Israel history, and you're like, this, it can't be. Just can't be. It's the existence, the proof of the existence of a spiritual power which outweighs all material might and power. And that's the battle. When it's dark, Esav attacks, and Esav thinks it has the upper hand, because in the darkness it does. It has the upper hand, and it attacks, but it can't ever destroy Yaakov. It can't ever fully pick him up and throw him down to the ground. But it can hurt us. The Esav's overpowering material resources impede, obstruct our ability to progress. But when the light shines, we'll see that that's not really what it's about. It's the spiritual power behind Yaakov that really outweighs all of it. It shows the existence of an almighty God who reveals himself just in the victorious endurance of this outwardly weak opponent, so that Yaakov is just therein to be regarded and understood as Yisrael. That's what the names mean. Yaakov reflects holding on to the heel. This is going to tie us all the way back to where we started. The introduction of Yaakov and Esav. Esav comes out first, powerful, and what's Yaakov doing? Holding on to his heel. Just barely holding on. At the end, the bottom, the heel. Your whole existence through history is going to be a reflection of that. A Yaakov. A Yaakov, a heel. At the end, the bottom. But at the end, you're going to reflect a different name. Yisrael. He who battled with God and was successful. He who shows a revelation of God within himself. It's going to reflect an entirely different nature of Yaakov. And that's what it is that we're working towards. Vatuchal, because the angel said, you have wrestled with man and with God, and you have been able, you have been successful, you have attained what you wished for, not I. You withstood my attack. You were successful. I wanted to destroy you, and I was not successful. All you wanted was not to be thrown down, and in that, you succeeded. That too is a relative position of Yaakov and Esau for all time. For all time, it's going to be Esav attacking Yaakov, trying to throw us down, but unable to. In politics and religion, Esav says, apart from me, there is no salvation. You cannot live in this world, Esav says, without me. Without Western civilization, without my religion, without my politics. He feels himself affected as long as a Yaakov exists apart from him. As long as there exists any element which considers itself to have the right to belong to the world and not acknowledge him. He's writing before Hitler. But this is exactly what Hitler wrote about and spoke. We are the salvation. And look at what he feels himself affected as long as he exists. The existence of the Jew
is
already a threat. I am affected because you exist. Again, he's writing way before that, 100 years before that almost. Mm-hmm. As long as there exists any element which considers itself to have the right to belong to the world and not acknowledge him, it says, I don't need Western civilization, I don't need your understanding of morality, I don't need your understanding of whatever it is that you have, I have a right to exist without that. That's a threat to the forces of Esav. Yaakov concedes all pure human beings the right to be left untouched. More, he declares all pure human beings have the highest meaning and destiny if they accept the basic principles of human life which he brings to them. If you accept my 7 mitzvahs of Bnei Noach, not to kill, not to steal, to have judgments, to have that form of morality, every human being, says Yaakov to the world, every human being who accepts the moral code, the principles of human life that I bring to them, can have the highest meaning and destiny. Blessing, acknowledgement, is all that Yaakov fights Esau for. Esau wants to destroy Yaakov, and Yaakov says, no, I want you to acknowledge that I'm the source of the highest morality and meaning and purpose in life. So Esau is coming with his might, trying to destroy, and Yaakov is coming with his morality, saying, recognize and blessing me, the highest achievement that a human being can have. Im Elokim ve'im anashim. You have, again, this is what the angel says, you have fought together with man and together with God. Hosea refers to this event in the Navi. Okay, we're going to see that. Let's do one last paragraph. Verse 30. Yaakov then says, what's your name? And the angel says, why do you ask me my name? And he blessed him there. Verse 30. Says it refers, why do you ask my name? The angel says, why do you want to know? When the sun does rise on earth, then all names will fade before the one name, of whom it says, Yihyeh Hashem Echad, Ushmo Echad. His name will be one, and he will be one. So again, we've seen different commentators. Why does the angel say, I don't have a name? Rashi quoted some of the Midrashim, my names always change, I always have different missions, so I don't have any specific name, or that you don't need to know my name because the battle is always coming from within you and your particular Yetzirah and your desire to do evil, whatever the comment is. But first says, you don't need to know my name because when dawn actually breaks, will all fade away into nothingness. All the powers, the forces that Esav represents in the world, the force of material strength, will not have a name. It will melt away before the one whose name is one, and who is one. On that day, Hashem will be Echad, Ushmo Echad. The only one on earth who will then have a name will be the one who did not want to make himself a name, and who did not want to join the rest of mankind when they said, Na'ase lonu shem. So he has a very poetic connection here. If you remember, we studied together the Tower of Babel, the building of the big tower, and that started when the people said, let us make a name for ourselves. So first, there's this very poetic tying in. The angel now says, I don't have a name. The whole dispersion of the 70 nations, the dispersion from the one people into many, started because people wanted to have a name. They wanted to have a presence. They wanted to be about me, about what I can accomplish. It started with the ability to have a name, and refers to it's going to end when we say, so what's your name? And they say, I don't have a name. My name has melted into the existence of the one to who did not want to be part of that having a name. Let's read that again inside as well. Now we know what he's talking about. And the only one on earth who will then have a name, that's us, will be the one who did not want to make himself a name, who did not want to join the mankind when they said, Na'ase lonu shem, of whom God therefore said, I will make your name great. That's Avram. He blessed him there. He blessed him there. That's from our verse. On the end of verse 30. And he blessed him there. Why there? There, certainly limited to that place. Why did it say the angel only specifically blessed him there? It was just there that Yaakov received the acknowledgement that he was to be blessed. Meaning there was now, at the end of this wrestling match, that Yaakov receives the word that he's going to be blessed. There at the border, where Yaakov was journeying to return the development of the Jewish spirit and the Abrahamic mission in the Jewish land. Thus, recognition and blessing does not beckon to his descendants by going with the stream of the world, but just Shom, there, by most complete entry into the apparently isolating destiny which the Jewish soil bears for all times. Let's talk this over. We'll read it again inside. Very poetic. He's saying, it's all about being there at this place where Yaakov wrestles, where Yaakov fights against the forces of the materialism that Esav represents, there where he's all into only about the development of the Jewish spirit and Abraham's mission of which he has, so that the Jewish blessing does not beckon to his descendants by going with the stream of the world. It's not come join us, but I will bless you there where you stood your ground and said you would not join in that which the rest of the world is swimming in, their stream. But by the complete entry into the apparently isolating destiny which the Jewish soil bears for all times. Very powerful phrase. Apparently isolating Jewish destiny, meaning by saying, I will not join the streams of the world in the way they approach the world, but by isolating myself into what I believe is right, which apparently is isolating, it seems like it is, really in reality is what? It's the opposite. Through isolating yourself and establishing the moral compass that the Jewish people represents, it's through that that the nations will then come to actually, eventually, bless and embrace and become part of that. So that it's he blessed him there where he remains isolated, locked in this one-on-one battle with the forces of Esav, that the angel blesses him.
So the whole situation is a spiritual layer.
Yeah. And again, as I mentioned, and refers to believes in practice, that's done amongst the nations of the world, but remaining loyal to the isolated Jewish destiny of moral compass, behavior, mitzvahs, Torah observance. So I'm within them, but I'm totally isolated from them in the way that I adhere to my Jewish destiny. And this is a direct attack on the Reform movement, saying you have to become part of the culture at large, join them, and he's saying, no, Only in joining the apparently isolating destiny will you then actually have the impact on them when you succeed. Very poetic language. Okay, we will pick up with this, Mirtz Hashem, a few more paragraphs in Refersh, and then we'll, we haven't yet gotten, then we'll get to part two, which is when Yaakov and Esav actually meet. This is all part one of the third episode. All right, my friends, have a great afternoon.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.